And we're back with an all-new Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Pertel.
And I'm Aida Osman. Hello. And more importantly, happy birthday, Ira.
Oh, I didn't even realize that it was my birthday.
Okay. Okay, you're feeling yourself a little too much today. I know Leo season, fine, Leo season can start. Y'all can have it now.
Home listeners may not understand this, but Ira is a living human being with organs and feelings and therefore does celebrate a birthday, and it happens to be today.
Oh, thank you, Bo. I had a lovely evening into my birthday. Ate some cake from Milk Bar.
Okay.
Watched an episode of Buffy. Did some crying.
Ooh, so quintessential Ira. Yeah.
Was it an emotional episode of Buffy, or is something the matter?
I mean, there's always something the matter, but yes, it was, it was the one where she killed Angel, season two.
Oh, got it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay. When,
and
that's
then
fair.
That Sarah McLachlan Pound Puppy song plays.
Don't let it be. In the arms.
Pound Puppies should be the name of that song. Yeah.
Actually, I think it's a different song, but they both sound the same. I don't really rock with Sarah McLachlan except in Buffy.
Weirdly, I don't either, as in I'm not a super fan, but I do love each of her singles. Like, I don't dislike any song she's ever put out. Building a Mystery, Adia, whatever. It's all great. Possession is the underrated one that Lilith Fair unfamiliar listeners might not know.
Oh, y'all are deep. I know Angel. I know Pound Puppy Song, and I call it a day. That's literally it. But I'm glad you had a good birthday. Do you have anything planned for the rest of the day?
Yeah, I'm going to have a cute little dinner. A friend is cooking me a dinner. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
Going to visit the Red Table.
Oh, sure. Wait, for your birthday, you can invite yourself to the Red Table? Is that how
it works? Yes. There's some healing that needs to be done.
Well,
I'm
34.
I'm bringing myself.
Because, I mean, truly. Now technically you are in your mid-30s. I mean, what does that feel like? By the way, I will literally be there 1 week from today, so we'll be having the same birthday conversation next week.
Will we? Will we be having that conversation?
It does seem to be up to you. That's true.
I would not like to have that conversation. I have to tell you that.
Well, also next week we may know if she's VP, so we will be having that conversation.
Mm.
Oh, my God. Whew. All sorts of treats.
Right.
But I am very excited about today's episode, actually, because we will be joined by playwright and television creator now, Katori Hall, of the new show, just renewed for season two yesterday, P-Valley on Stars.
Which is sensational. I'm so glad I watched five
really
episodes.
Truly.
Yeah.
It's so fucking good. And the original title, of course, is Pussy Valley.
It's fun to say.
That was the name of the play that it was based on. I just think that we should say things as they were meant to be said, Aida. So if I have
their
to
government
say,
name.
So if I have to say pussy this early in the morning, I'm going to say pussy.
I know. It's just like the P is so P, you know? You're really pushing it for
okay.
me.
Okay. This pussy
girl,
talk,
do what you have
English,
to do.
Spanish, and French.
Oh, no.
What was the last play to be adapted into a TV show? I immediately thought of Tracy Letts' Superior Donuts, which was turned into a sitcom that resembled the play not at all.
I think that might be it.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation. Oh.
Superior Donuts was shockingly a more disappointing TV show than it was a play. And that's all I have to say about that.
Ever since Ordinary People, I've rooted for Judd Hirsch. But I mean, the donuts, slightly inferior. Yes.
Wonderful. I'm going to get back to y'all when I start reading plays.
Don't start.
We're going.
Don't, if you're going to read a Tracy Letts, if you're going to start a Tracy Letts, do not start with Superior Donuts, baby.
Okay.
Because
okay, good. Good to
Superior
know.
Superior Donuts is one of those stories about like a cranky old white man who has a come to Jesus moment because of a young black man that enters his life.
Oh, I remember this because Jermaine Fowler is in this.
Jermaine Fowler
is
in the, was in the
love.
TV show.
He's
so funny.
I'm on board. I'm on board now. He's hilarious. He's hilarious. I love him. I might just watch it just to see that fine man do his fine man things.
Jermaine Fowler is hilarious and he is fine, but it's just not my kind of story. I don't love helping old white men.
That's fair.
Even when I've slept with them in the past, I don't help them. I help myself.
Wow, girl.
Well, I think technically by sleeping with them, you made them worse. So I think that was good.
Yeah. Ask the doctor who won't call me back. Anyway, we're also going to get into some folklore.
Sure.
Okay.
And then we've got a little thing called the Emmy nominations happening.
Have I ever heard of them?
Happening truly as we speak. So
yes,
you will get our takes hot off the press, and they won't be so hot when you're listening to them because they'll be a day after everyone else's takes. But ours are the most important. So.
Right.
That's very true.
And the most knee-jerk. So get ready for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it'll be a lot of me complaining about the show Ozark again. So strap in, okay. Babies.
We'll be right back. Y'all.
What?
Something wrong. I hold my head. Regis gone. Our nigga dead.
Stop! I don't need this. I need support. I need comfort.
Listen,
I don't need this.
Regis stayed on in black households, okay?
He is my father, my mother. He's everything to me. He awakened my love of knowledge and trivia. Like, this man is everything for me.
Truly the father I never had.
When you tweeted that, Regis stayed on in black households. Did you mean primarily because of the Kathy Lee show or the Kelly show or because of Millionaire?
Both.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like people watched Millionaire because of Regis.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
You know, like, we tuned in because, like, we loved Regis from back in the day.
Definitely.
You know, like, Regis and Kathy were it. They were, like, the white friends who would come over and visit, just bringing gifts, being funny, being wacky, and you let them.
And yeah, you would let them stay.
Yeah.
Which is rare. That's exactly what they were. And I always was thrown by their age difference, but there was something so endearing about it. I loved it. I loved them.
It's not a thing of sitcoms. Like there are a lot of, like, you know, black people, working class. There was the one white friend of your mom's who was yeah. always over.
Yeah.
usually a coworker or a neighbor.
Uh-huh.
But
mine was a Julie. She tufted rugs. She was very kind. I let her stay. We loved her. We loved having Julie over.
Mine was my mom's coworker. She was Jewish. And so we used to do, like, Jewish holidays.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's cute. Now, Regis, to me, was, like, the point of that show is always Regis announcing that he went to dinner with his wife, Joy, last night.
Which yes! Is just,
we had to hear about it every time. Every time we had to hear about it.
Well, he had to eat dinner every night.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Who they'd run into, where they went, like, what they saw, if they saw a play or a movie or something. That is the old days of, like, talk shows that I truly, really miss. And honestly, why I love... Even, like, doing this show, like, just, like, not to be so saccharine about it, you know, but I think the one thing about podcasts is that you are listening to people and you get to know them every week. And I'm sure some people come here to hear us talk about bullshit, like Taylor Swift albums and, you know, my Omarosa jokes. But, you know, I think they also get attached to parts of our lives. You know, we talked about that last week with Aminatu and Anne, you know, like, they get attached to what we deliver them from our lives. And Regis was really just sort of that quintessential person who, when you tuned in, he wasn't just some celebrity, like, interviewing people, you know, you were also finding out more about Regis every day.
We've had a lot of deaths every week, but this one hurts.
He also had, like, a genuine just enthusiasm about everything. Yeah. It did not feel contrived, even though he also is, like, the last vestige of somebody who comes from old school broadcasting. So the way he said everything had just that kind of radio feel, or had the feel of, like, you know, like a talk show host from the 50s or something like that.
Yes.
I happened to rewatch old episodes of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. I know, twist my arm. But two things I loved about him on that show. One, during the fastest finger part where the contestants have to get a multiple choice question correct and then Regis calls off the person who got it in the fastest time and pulls them to the stage, whenever he called their name, the contestant would first be terrified because Regis was screaming the name at them. So funny every time. And then secondly, this thing would happen on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when, like, a contestant would need a lifeline early on. Like, whatever, they needed to ask the audience because they didn't know how the phrase duck, duck, blank ended, right? And then Regis would turn to the audience and he goes, "Well, I guess our friend needs a little help here." Like that. Always, like, sympathetic, but knowing it was so stupid. He was always so good at handling things like that.
But also would always clown someone's lifeline when it was the call a friend and the friend was, like, unuseful.
Yeah.
Yeah, fully, fully. He liked to test you if he's like, "Are you really sure? Are you sure about that final answer?" And Yeah, I just love him. He's just hilarious. He really knows how to mess with you. He could have been an actor for real. And I do actually remember from being a child, him doing appearances on WrestleMania and Lilo and Stitch and being like, yep, yes. I can hear the Regis in the voice.
Mm. I do want to say, though, that Regis is the rare case of somebody who was a pre-existing celebrity in one format and then became an amazing game show host. Most of the time, I hate when celebrities become game show hosts because there's a whole set of skills that goes along with being a great MC, and it has nothing...
You talk about Drew Carey.
he's doing fine. He's doing fine. But I'm just saying, like, we give things like the host of Press Your Luck to Elizabeth Banks, who is, a talented person, but there's a whole different set of skills that goes with making a contestant feel comfortable that is not, we liked you in some comedies before. I don't know. I'm always a little bit wary when a celebrity jumps into that position.
Mm-hmm. Cedric the Entertainer, I enjoy.
Oh, on Millionaire?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's fun. And Steve Harvey on Feud.
Yeah, Steve Harvey's good on Feud. He knows how to do that. Yeah. He definitely knows.
He really, like, makes a meal out of every moment with each individual member of that family. Like, he'll hold a stare for a minute and a half, like, where there's no gameplay.
It's that same, honestly, abhorrent, like, menacing quality of, like, I'm going to fuck with you because I know I have the power right now. And yeah. He plays it up super well with all them little yeah. is not the right word for his teeth.
But also, as you recall, do not enter Steve Harvey's dressing room.
Right.
Wait. No. Aida doesn't know what this is.
Oh,
what are you talking about?
Like, a couple years ago, there was a story where he, like, sent a memo to his staff of, like, do not enter my dressing room.
Oh, no.
Don't make contact with me. It was rude, but also correct.
Yeah. He invented contactless delivery before the pandemic. That's fine.
We also lost this week Olivia de Havilland.
My God.
Oh.
An actress.
Quite. 2 Oscars when she died. A lot of people tweeted at me about it, and I was like, this is strange. Why is this happening? We talked about her last week on this show. How fucking crazy mm-hmm. is that?
But I feel like you talk about Olivia de Havilland every day.
I was going to say, boo, don't try and make
right.
this a coincidence. You're making permanence a coincidence, and I won't have it, bro. No. No way.
That's a good point. Here's the thing. Nobody is surprised she died. But at the same time,
truly, the bitch was 104, okay?
Right.
Like, every day that she was still alive, I was constantly like, well, damn, she is really going to stay alive so she can ruin Ryan Murphy's life.
But, like, at the same time, you kind of thought she would never die. So it was a really strange, like, thing in your brain that you couldn't reconcile that was just awesome that we got to, like, have for so long. But, I mean, she really is the last bridge to, you know, a completely ancient era of movies. I mean, this is somebody who debuted on the screen in 1935. I want to be clear, that is Alfred Hitchcock's old career. Not even, like, the end of Alfred Hitchcock's career.
Right.
But so many incredible performances. If you can find The Heiress, which isn't streaming anywhere, almost anywhere, but you get her and you get Hot Montgomery Clift.
Monty.
Yeah.
She did what needed to be done in The Heiress. The Heiress is a hot movie.
Totally.
And you know I love Montgomery Clift.
One of the hotties of all time. And also, back when, like, hot people had torture in their eyes, like, you were trying to decode what was wrong with them.
Mm-hmm. Robert Pattinson.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was she cremated? I want to get my Gone with the Wind joke off.
Oh, go ahead.
That was it. That was the whole thing. I'm sorry for your loss, Lewis. I am very sorry whenever one of your white women dies. Like, I really do. For you. I do.
I want to also highlight how utterly ridiculous this white woman was. I was reading this Vanity Fair profile of her that was done in her last days, and so she basically left the U.S. because she was sick of the movie industry. She was like, this is not the movie industry that I remember, which it's not the old glamour anymore, which is hilarious because I would say that, like, her age of cinema, like, after it is, like, a truly glamorous, amazing age of cinema.
Oh, yeah.
But
uh-huh.
I guess, it, you know, if you're coming from where she's from, someone who also started, you know, like, out in Shakespeare and thought that she wanted to do that and wished that she had done that and wished that she had also, like, gone to school instead of becoming, like, an actress. Like, for her, she was probably just like, I ain't got time for this shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the profile even mentions that, like, she moved to Paris and, like, she wasn't even like hanging out with like Truffaut, you know, or Godard. Like she wasn't even up in the French cinema scene. Like she was truly done. Just hanging out with like royalty and going to parties and having salons. But she was obviously remembered because of her feud with her sister, Miss Fontaine. They're also, I believe, the only two sisters who both have Oscars.
They were the first sisters to be nominated in the same year. Eventually, Lynn and Vanessa Redgrave would also be nominated in the same year, but Lynn never won an Oscar. So
yeah. And so they have that feud, but there's this story she tells about how like she was back in the U.S. and what really sort of ended it for her was she was at this party and there was this old man looking at her who, and like the way she tells it, like it's like this ghost, this homeless man just like staring at her like about to murder her. And then all of a sudden she feels like a kiss on the back of her neck and someone says, Olivia. And then she looks and like, who is it? And they say, it's Errol. And she realizes it's Errol Flynn, and she's like, he's aged so much and doesn't look like the young man that was like sexy and in films with her and abusing women.
Right.
But anyway,
yes.
They sit down for a dinner, and then he starts like flirting with and talking to all the younger actresses and everything too. And I think that's when she was like, this is not my place anymore. And I feel like part of it was her also being like, realizing that like as you age in Hollywood, like there's no use for you as a woman.
Right.
So I feel like part of her like story of I left for Paris, I was over Hollywood, etc., was also part of like the misogyny of the era too.
Right. She had a couple of notable parts in her, like in the 60s and 70s. She was in Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, which she did as a favor to Betty Davis. And then she's in like the unbelievably shitty disaster movie The Swarm, which also features my girl Lee Grant. Look her up. Best Supporting Actress, 1975.
Also, what's the private elevator film?
Oh, A Lady in a Cage.
A Lady in a Cage. Mess.
But that was chronicled on Feud, and of course, yes. One of the last, her last acts was suing Ryan Murphy for the way she was portrayed in Feud, which remains my favorite thing Ryan Murphy has ever done, even if it completely dramatizes the Joan Crawford-Betty Davis feud, which was not the story it was made out to be on that show.
Also played by Miss Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Correct, yes, which is a weird fit. Yeah,
it is. I mean, I feel like maybe now that she's gone, the better feud that wouldn't be trumped up so much as the Joan and Betty one was would be Olivia and her sister.
Yeah, I mean, Olivia literally called Joan Fontaine Dragon Lady once upon a time. So
yeah.
This is the like age-old story of Joan's threatening to kill her sister at like 9, right? Like as a young child.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. it's a lot of piecing together like, is somebody here mentally ill, maybe? Like, it's, yeah. But, I mean, God bless. We got her, and we had Joan Fontaine for a long time, too. So, I mean, it's a pretty incredible duo altogether.
Yeah, she died around, like, 2013. Right? Mm-hmm. So, like, she stayed in the game for a minute, too. That would be an epic story to tell.
Yeah, right. And I think it will be, obviously, now that they're both gone.
As long as Ryan doesn't do it.
You never know.
He will. Don't worry. If I know Ryan Murphy in any way, shape, or form, he gonna get the rights and do the thing. That's what he does.
If an old woman gets a monologue, look out for Ryan Murphy. Yeah.
Before we dive into these Emmy nominations, there is also some other great news this week. Shea Coulee won Drag Race All-Stars, as we all knew she would.
We love to see it. We love to see
literally
it.
Who else was going to win? I mean, Jujubee was also great this season, but it was pretty much Shea Coulee's to lose.
I personally don't even enjoy a season where I know who's going to win by the end of it. Like, I was for Shay with Shay the whole time. There was not a mystery at all. Absolutely not at all.
I give credit to the show for delaying or throwing a couple wrenches into play to make you think the inevitable wasn't going to happen. But, I mean, at the end, like, you would never pick in this season Ms. Cracker over Shea Coulee. I mean, like, Ms. Cracker was amusing, but Shea Coulee, like, just the exquisiteness of her looks.
The
and
precision.
The way, yes. The calculated way she would come into, like, just give you personality and, like, jokes about how she lost the past season. She had planned it so hard. And you just can't argue with that kind of gameplay.
Congrats.
The season, as lackluster as it was, she was great, obviously. I thought Jujubee was great.
Jujubee, fabulous.
I've been really enjoying Drag Race Canada.
Oh, girl.
Although I have a bone to pick with some people who continue to say that the judges are too mean.
I would say that's the prevailing sentiment about that show, that the judges are all together to me. And I, here's where I'll sympathize. I feel like they're trying to imitate the judges on Drag Race, but like Jeffrey Boyer Chapman does not have a gift for sauciness, and so he compensates for what I would call just mean comments.
Mm-hmm. I would say he is the mean one. I definitely think that Stacey McKenzie is very constructive. I love her. She's my favorite judge.
She's great. Always looks great. Yeah.
Yes. Brooklyn Heights is fun. The looks aren't always as snatched as Rue's are, but there it has sort of like this janky, a bit ghetto, a bit hood sense to it, you know, the first season, like the first season of Drag Race was. And maybe that's also what just connects it with Legendary. I feel like Drag Race has become so overproduced, so mainstream, so much geared towards middle American white women in the way that a lot of gay entertainment eventually becomes, so that it can become successful, and it's not really on the fringe anymore. And Drag Race at least feels like it is being geared towards gay people. I just assume like mostly gays have WoW Presents Plus, you know, that the WoW, the World of Wonder streaming service, not Kirsten in Idaho Falls.
Right, right. But which, by the way, is how you watch Drag Race Canada, the WoW Presents app, if you want to get into it. Only a few episodes have aired so far, so you're not behind.
I just love the like fact that it feels like a little fresh, you know? It's not insanely mainstream right now, and I really do think that, like, unfortunately, RuPaul, in sort of promoting himself through Drag Race, has sort of made the show sort of predictable, and also it's just become not what it was, you know? You watch the show and everything is a commercial for a new RuPaul song or RuPaul's podcast or something else, and it's just this commercialization of queerness that feels a lot like the way gay pride parades are like brought to you by Bank of America, right?
No, by the way, there's something I do like about that. Even the horrible corporate nature of it. It's like, oh, you see me. Like you, a corporate entity, look at gay queer people and see a dollar sign in some way. I'm oddly flattered. That's all I can say. Yeah.
Commodify me, baby. At least you see me.
True. But RuPaul shouldn't be the corporate entity, you know?
Yeah.
And I shouldn't decry Ru because Ru went through shit, you know, in the 90s and 80s, you know, like to get to where Ru is now. But unfortunately,
from Crooklyn to here.
From Crooklyn to here,
from
you know.
Yeah, this was not inevitable. This was not an inevitable thing. Yeah.
But I think what it should be is RuPaul should separate himself from the show and do RuPaul branding and just be RuPaul. You can afford to do that now and someone else can do Drag Race. Girl, we are ready. The girls are ready.
I think the one thing I like about Drag Race Canada is just the sort of absence of RuPaul, unfortunately. You know, Ru seems to want to be this Brene Brown, Ellen DeGeneres character now, which is great. You've earned it, baby. But also makes the show not what it was.
That makes me yearn for RuPaul's Game of Games, because I think that would be a specific kind of torture. That'd be exciting.
I think we're ready for these Emmy nominations.
They're coming in. They're coming in. I'm super excited. I just got word that Big Mouth got nominated.
Oh, how exciting.
For an animated show. I know. And Jimmy Kimmel, so look at us.
Oh, did we provide entertainment for everybody? You're welcome.
Did we? Did a little something for the kids.
Well, it's so nice of you two to finally be a part of Emmy-nominated writing team.
Girl, chill. Chill with the finally. Chill with the finally.
As you know, I was a part of an Emmy-nominated television series as an actor.
Okay. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. Speak on that.
And you were nominated for what exactly? Eviction from the Big Brother house?
Girl, I wish. But I would be winning Big Brother. You know I could win Big Brother.
I think, well, I think any queer person has the ability to win Big Brother because it's about making people believe you're their best friend when in fact you're just keeping them at bay.
Strategizing is in our blood.
I mean, R.I.P. Megan Amram, but I was in an Emmy for Megan, which was nominated for an Emmy last year.
Oh, you were in an Emmy for Megan, huh?
Yeah.
Billy on the Street was nominated for Variety Series the last time I wrote on a season. Don't worry, we're all in the game, sweetie.
Okay, well, fine. Well, then let's just celebrate me.
I don't know who Billy is, and I've never heard of a street.
Okay, great.
but these nominations.
Yes.
First of all, Zendaya.
Great nomination.
Euphoria. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
I'm ready. Because wasn't she snubbed for a Golden Globe?
Yes.
I'm sure she
yes.
was.
What that's like such an unusual show that goes darker than you expect, but then also like eventually like lighter than you expect too. So, I mean, she brings you so much dimension on that show.
Yeah.
I've been finally diving into it with my friend Royce, and I would say that the show is so incredibly earnest, but also, yes, it gives you that dark, sort of salacious, almost ADHD storytelling, in that it whips from scene to scene, music cues, even for just like a walk down a hallway. It's almost music video-esque, but it feels very like earnest. It's telling a very sweet story amidst everything, and I think that's why it connects with younger millennials, Gen Z people, you know? I think that it's sort of that commodification of the storytelling that we were doing, you know? We had shows that blended horror and comedy, and then we had things that were very saccharine and earnest, and I think that this manages to be both of them. So I'm very happy for Euphoria.
I'm checking out the supporting actor in a comedy series nominations. Dan Levy's in the house. That's very exciting.
Of course,
we love to see that.
And also Kenan Thompson, who is entering his 74th season of Saturday Night Live, and I believe it's well deserved.
Which is wild after 20 seasons of Kenan and Kel.
Oh, and 15 of all that. So I don't know how he's making time. But I mean, I feel like Schitt's Creek always is going to appear. As long as Schitt's Creek has a season, it's going to be up there. I'm a big fan of every single person on that show. Congrats to Rami, who you guys know I love because I love Muslim comics, who got nominated for lead actor in a comedy series, who we know got the Golden Globe, but I didn't actually know if he was going to show up on the Emmy nominations, but lo and behold, thank Allah, he is here. So we'll see what happens, but he's going up against a lot of people.
Which reminds me, like, the TV nominations for the Golden Globes are the wild, wild west. We've talked about how they get nominated for a variety of reasons, like the show is very new and they want to award the newness more than the quality of the show, so you never know how this is going to translate to the Emmys.
Yes.
But, I mean, I'm looking at Yvonne Orji nominated for Insecure.
Yes.
Annie Murphy's nominated. Cecily Strong is nominated from Saturday Night Live. Low-key SNL hero, always dependable.
Yep.
Those are exciting nominations. Like, I love that. I also do have a question. What is the Kominsky method?
People
are always talking about the Kominsky method. And I thought, at first I thought it was a limited series. I thought it was a movie. Now it apparently is a comedy series that is still on.
We have never heard of this.
All I know is that it exists and that Alan Arkin does Alan Arkin-y snark on it, I suppose. Alan Snarkin, that's him. There's no other. There's nothing else you can know about that.
It looks like Grace and Frankie for men. What is this?
Right.
I really don't know what it's about.
Gary and Frank is the name of the show, correct? By the way, I think the category to watch this year might be supporting actress in a limited series or movie, which gives you Holland Taylor in Hollywood, which she was fabulous in. That's a great nomination. Uzo Aduba, Margot Martindale, and Tracy Ullman from Mrs. America, a show that I swear existed, and I once talked to you about every week on this show, but nobody has talked about it since. Cate Blanchett, obviously nominated too. And then Toni Collette, Unbelievable, and then Jean Smart and Watchmen.
Oh, dope.
Probably Jean Smart will take it. That said, it's a great category.
I'm proud of that.
We also have Sarah Snook and Nicholas Braun, Kieran Culkin, Matthew McFadden.
Baby.
Basically, the Emmy said the entire cast of Succession is getting nominations.
Succession? Succeeded.
Which is great because it is white excellence.
Okay.
Like The Talented Mr. Ripley. Yeah, there's a small category of white excellence. Yes. Matthew McFadden, 2005 Pride and Prejudice Hive, rise up. Yeah. I mean,
white boy magic. Okay? Mm. White boy magic.
Speaking of white excellence, I mean, it's unfortunate that Killing Eve has gone in the creative direction that they've gone in, and that's all I'll say about that. But love me some Jodie Comer, and I hope that she gets whatever she deserves, whatever the woman deserves.
I would like her to be a multiple Emmy winner myself. I concur on that one.
True.
Miss Betty Gilpin.
Duh.
Yeah. Dylan McDermott. Still the finest man that's ever been on TV.
Definitely. And also Jim Parsons nominated for Hollywood. The end of Hollywood was, I think as we discussed in the show, very crazy. And like made you wonder why we did this exercise altogether. But Jim Parsons as a nefarious gay guy of yore, like a manipulative studio exec type, it really worked for me. I really enjoyed dark Jim Parsons and hope we get more of that.
Were there also only three sketch series this year?
Probably so.
I'm so happy for a Black Lady sketch show, but also it just feels like there are three shows were nominated.
I strongly believe that Sherman Showcase should have been nominated.
Yes. Drop It Low for Jesus deserved a nomination alone.
Truly. And I think You Should Leave, Tim Robinson, was a wonderful show. I'm not quite sure why it's not here either, but it might be the acceptance period of when they can be nominated.
Also, Astronomy Club was done dust.
Girl.
By Netflix.
Truly.
By Netflix, too.
By literally everyone. And it was such a good show. I recommend you watch it immediately.
I just want to reiterate before we wrap this up, supporting actress in a drama series. I mean, inevitably, one of your faves of all time is in here. It's Laura Dern, Meryl Streep, Helena Bonham Carter, Samira Wiley, Fiona Shaw, Julia Garner, Sarah Snook, Tandy Newton. I mean, it sounds like a gay guy talking in his sleep. I mean, look, yeah.
Samira Wiley, I love her so much.
Where's Angela Bassett?
Girl, being 64 and fine somewhere. Where is Angelica Ross?
They killed her ass. The Emmys could have given her a nom.
I know.
That is actually, I would say, a shocking sort of...
a little snub.
Snub, if you will. Billy Porter is nominated for Pose, but... Otherwise,
Pose isn't. There's no Pose at all except for Billy Porter. That's devastating.
It's also just unfortunate. I mean, shows at the Emmys like peak. Like, if they have a gigantic year, it's unlikely generally that they will keep it up season to season to season. Like, Breaking Bad's an exception. You know,
Miss Maisel, I keep having to look at.
Yeah, remember when we accidentally just gave Jane Lynch another Emmy? Like, the other.
What?
She's like, whatever, I'll take it. And now she's going to be a Weakest Link host. This is what I'm saying about game show hosts.
Jane Lynch will do a good job at that, though.
Yeah, I think so.
I feel like she's got the snide you need.
I will just say that to wrap up, I'm very excited, you know, for people like Yvonne, you know, Annie Murphy, Dan Levy, and Billy Porter, obviously. But I am a little shocked, you know. I mean, I think that the narrative really is always that, like, quote, unquote, the people on Pose aren't great actors, you know. But I would disagree. And I just rewatched, like, the second season
when
it hit Netflix. And I just think MJ Rodriguez is phenomenal. So is India Moore. And I really think that there's still work to do in terms of Emmy nominations and what we see as, quote-unquote, Emmy material, you know?
Yeah. And I'm very happy about the way, we're moving toward this more kind of naturalistic slice of life way of acting where everything is subtle and everything is subdued. But I like a performance, bitch, and the people on Pose give you that. So that is what I enjoy about that show. They're not bad actors. They are truly acting.
I'm acting.
Girl.
All right, when we're back, we'll be joined by Miss Katori Hall.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
We are so excited to have here Memphis native Katori Hall, who is an Olivier award-winning playwright. Okay, fuck the Tonys.
Yeah.
Olivier is where it is at. The first Black woman to do it as well.
Yes.
And now showrunner of P-Valley, the new show on Stars, which is everything. Truly everything.
We love this show.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm so happy. I'm so happy you guys love it. I'm so happy.
Yeah, it's just like, in this era, too, of hustlers, you know, like, I feel like people are like, yes, let's see a series about women working in a strip club in the South. But it is so much more than that, you know, like, to just even compare it to that is... basic, you know, it is so full of the lives of these Black people in the South, and it just feels so urgent. It feels so necessary. You're just really getting these full depictions of their lives, and, like, of course you're a playwright. The dialogue in the series alone is worth the price of admission.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, we be working hard on the dialogue. I'm like, we got to do the volley, y'all. It got to be the rat-a-tat-tat, boom-tat-tat, you know. It has to have its own kind of music, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you noticing it.
So this originated as a play, and in turning it into a TV series, like, what were the critical elements you wanted to keep? And then what had to change in order to make it into, you know, the TV show that we now love?
It's interesting. So the play version was the culmination of 6 years of research. Like, mm-hmm. I went all over the nation. We did a deep, deep, deep dive. And so when I saw the play version, I was just like, ooh, child, this is a lot. Like, this is 3.5 hours, which is like, you know, most people, like, they ain't sitting in a play for no 3.5 hours. And it was like this particular parenthesis that was just like screaming to be broken open. So I knew what was in front of me was a TV show. The fact that you had these characters that you wanted to stay with for years, not just for 3.5 hours. The story was very contained. It was all set inside of the club. And, you know, as a Black woman who grew up in the South, you know, I have so many things I want to write about in terms of talking about racism, unpacking this inheritance of poverty and just oppression. And so I was just like, how can I, you know, meld all of my experiences as a Black woman to all of this research that I've done with these strippers and in these strip clubs and using these amazing, lovable characters? And so I would say the biggest thing that I took from the play version was just the characters. The Uncle Clifford's, you know, the LaMurda, the, you know, Mercedes, like everyone just stayed intact because I knew that even in the theatrical form, audiences love being in the room with these people. And so, you know, it's like, bloop, you take them out of the play and then now you have this open-ended, you know, hopefully years-long story that you can tell with these characters. And with that ingredient, that basic ingredient of the characters, I was able to tell all of the stories that I have been wanting to tell beyond the strip club. And, you know, with Starz being the network that we landed at, they were just really open to this humanization project and the fact that I wanted to go and bust beyond the walls and take on these very almost Shakespearean themes when it comes to being Black in the South.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I have really enjoyed about it too is just seeing these interior lives of Southern Black people, which is what we don't see on television. We don't see on film that much, you know, unless it's some slave shit, you know? Because, like, you know, I'm from Milwaukee, but everyone in my family before then was born in Tennessee. My mom was the last one born in Tennessee before they came up for high school.
Yes, yeah. Tennessee.
Yeah, Tiptonville, Tennessee. Literally a town of like 1,000 people. I've been there once. Yeah. Hot as fuck.
You're like, I ain't going there again. No.
How do you feel, you know, just about representations of Black people in general, and what do you want to tell differently? We've seen so many different representations of Black people, I feel like, on TV now, but so much of them are like the Olivia Popes, you know, like existing in these white spaces, or they're upper middle class Black people, you know, like a Blackish, you know, like a Black AF, you know, and it is rare that we see something like this that also gets to be written by Black people, you know, like it's not Treme.
Absolutely. Child, I am so happy that you're asking this question because I've always been very frustrated with, I would say, this very kind of West Coast, East Coast representation of Black life. Mm-hmm. And growing up, you know, this Southerner who moved to the North, you know, was in New York City for school and was often made fun of by even my best friend, you know, the way I talk. Like, I would wear my socks up real high, which was hella country. And, like, it was country ghetto. That's what she said. So it was this thing of never really seeing my specific self, my culturally specific self reflected in what I think the mirror that media can be. And so I do feel as though there's been these slight representations of black folks down south. Like I think about True Blood. I think about the character Lafayette, you know, which a lot of people think of when they think about Uncle Clifford. But I'm like, no, they're very different. They're very different. But that aside, I just feel as though there is, when we think about the South, you know, slavery comes up real quick in our minds. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that tends to be the representation of Black South that I would say Hollywood puts out into the world, even though, you know, there's Queen Sugar now, but, you know, that's been in the past 5 years. And so I had this deep desire to just really create something that was truly from my particular heritage. Like, not everybody who grows up in the South and who's Black talks like the way that my characters speak, but I know that my family speaks that way. I know that my family used to be sharecroppers. I know that even my mother had to pick cotton, even though slavery did not exist. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to put forth what I think is a very complicated space as a Black Southerner, where you are truly in the past and present simultaneously. Like, you are constantly being reminded of your history. And I feel as though this story, this world, is an opportunity to very much be unapologetic about all of that and to highlight and embrace things that a lot of people are like, ooh, I didn't know Black folks, you know, did the do-rags all the time. And it's like, you know, we can just be ourselves and be free in a way that does not have this kind of white gaze upon us, and also doesn't necessarily have this, I would say, respectability politics within the Black gaze that I know that a lot of people are subscribing to when it comes to what good representations of Black folks are. It's just like, I want to be able to have my uncles and my dad and my mama to be like, yes, that's me. Katori got me right. Like, that's how I talk. That's how I interact in the world. Like, that's the type of clubs that I go to. That's the church I go to. It is beautiful. It is very kind of Zora Neale Hurstian, which is, you know, she is a literary god of mine when it comes to the language and embracing us as our Black, you know, and country selves.
Yes. I literally just read Barracoon, the story of the last Black cargo, that nonfiction interview that she did with the last living survivor of the Middle Passage. Such a fucking amazing book.
Oh, see, I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. So
on the list.
I was thinking about what information I even know casually about strip club culture, and obviously it would be different in one part of the country than it is another. Like, our friend Diablo Cody wrote a book called Candy Girl about her time as a stripper in Minneapolis and the sort of the culture within the club and who has to pay who and like the hierarchy that's going on in a club situation. What were the things you got from researching that we would not intuitively guess about strip clubs or working in one or, you know, making a living off one?
I think the biggest thing that I took from my research was, you know, there is this assumption that when you come into a strip club that people are just taking off their clothes and, you know, it's a sad and seedy place. And yes, I will say that is true to some extent. But when it comes to these Black Southern strip clubs, like, the athleticism, the skill set that is required to pull yourself up on that pole, and the bravery that is required to turn yourself up down and fall from the sky. I think people don't understand how theatrical of an experience it is. So, yeah, this idea of these women looking like super heroes in the sky is something that is very foreign, I think, to most people. And when I would go to all of these clubs and meet these women, you would get this visual of them just, like I said, being these Wonder Women and showing off how athletic and how much of a craft it is. But then they would, like, you know, climb down off the pole and go backstage and just become like me. Like, this human being complaining about her boyfriend, complaining about her dental bill, complaining about, you know, I hope I can pay the rent, you know, this month. So it was this beautiful thing that I confronted, and it enlightened me so much. Like, there's this very thin line between the grit and glitter in this world. And so the fact that you have these amazing women who are doing an art form, and then all of a sudden, boom, within, you know, the turn of a dime, they just become so real and so raw. That to me was the thing that I really wanted to make an audience understand, that these women are our sisters, they're our mothers, and that they have a lot to say about what it means to survive in a patriarchal system. Like the strip club, to me, it's just a metaphor for the world that women live in. The fact that, yes, it's an extremely exploitative space, but somehow, by hook or by crook, these women who oftentimes are impoverished, oftentimes don't have that many choices, they figure out a way to liberate themselves. They figure out a way to claim financial freedom, create art in a space where people don't think art exists. It, to me, is a reflection of not only being a woman, but also just being a Black person in this world. And so going into these spaces, I really, really saw myself. I really saw my own struggles walking in the world. And for me, the show is really about a group of predominantly Black women who just happens to be strippers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, first response to that, I mean, the athleticism alone, there is a moment in episode three, and if y'all listening have not watched, like episode three, where Brandi Evans, who is fucking fantastic as Mercedes.
Isn't she?
Like, fucking her. Fantastic. The moment where she is on the pole, and I think it shifts to just like, there's no sound and you're just hearing her breathing, and it's almost her POV of her like on the ceiling, and you're watching it and you're thinking like, is she gonna fall? Is this like telling us that like she's like losing her breath, gonna fall or something? You're like, no, you're seeing the athleticism and you are seeing the strength that she has. And that was such a beautiful moment to watch when talking about these women surviving, you know, and especially in this patriarchal world. What I found really interesting is that the person who owns the club is Uncle Clifford, who is, you know, non-binary and uses pronouns she, and we're always seeing Uncle Clifford in these amazing fucking get-ups. And I want to know a bit about your inspiration behind that, and also your inspiration too behind just depicting such great representations of Black queer men that we don't get to see in your work, because particularly when I was in New York right before quarantine, you know, I saw your new play, Hot Wing King, which was, you know, like four fucking Black gay men, you know, like entering a hot wing contest in Memphis. And, you know, I'm like, this is something that I have not seen before. And it just felt so exciting to watch parts of myself on stage in theater in a way that I hadn't really seen before, you know, except in like some of like Terrell McCraney's work or something, you know.
Absolutely. So your first question about Uncle Clifford. Uncle Clifford's exist in this world. You know that, I know that, a lot of people know that. However, it's that thing of so much homophobia still existing within our community, and our Uncle Cliffords don't get an opportunity to shine. So I always wanted the momager of the club to be someone who was queer. Initially, I would, you know, Uncle Clifford in the play version started off as a trans woman. Mm-hmm. But then I decided that because we hadn't seen that many non-binary representations in the media, I felt like actually the person that I had been striving for to create was someone who was feminine and masculine in equal measure. And so someone that was non-binary to me was just, you know, perfect for this Uncle Clifford that was in my mind. Now, in terms of who Uncle Clifford is based off of, so I got three living ancestors that have their DNA embedded in Uncle Clifford. It's my mama, who be scared of her because she don't take no mess. is my daddy, who the same way, like he be carrying his gun all the time, he be fishing, but yet he's so nurturing, he's so loving. And then you got my real Uncle Clifford, who can read you for 1 second and kiss you on the forehead the next. Like, that's just who he is, and you just gotta accept it. And what's interesting is that none of them are queer, but I wanted to make sure that the Uncle Clifford that I created was just felt so real. He's made from words, she's made from words, but definitely based off of life and painted from life. And that's why her personality is so off the chain, because she just got all of these layers of people that I have seen and been with my entire life. But then, of course, there is a bit of, like, you know, Messy Maya up in Uncle Clifford. There's a bit of my brother who is gay, that's all up in Uncle Clifford. Like, you know, Uncle Clifford is truly an homage to a community that I feel truly needs to be represented in all the complexities and all the nuances that I have been able to witness. And so what's been so crazy is just how so many people have embraced Uncle Clifford. Like, people that I didn't even know was going to be like, that's my favorite character. Like, I remember had a conversation with Snoop Dogg recently. Isn't that crazy? Oh. Like, oh, Snoop Dogg, like the show. Yes. And, you know, finding out, loving Uncle Clifford. And that's me. That's everything. The fact that despite what we struggle with as a community, they see the human being. They see the love. They see the mama hen, the tough talker, the pimp and the therapist all in this one person. Because quite frankly, we all got a little Uncle Clifford inside of us. And I just think it goes to show you, like, how powerful storytelling can be. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can take people who have been stigmatized and dehumanized or made invisible, completely invisible, put them in the living rooms of your Snoop Dogs. And for folks like that to be like, yeah, I fucks with Uncle Clifford. Like, to me, that's a type of revolution in itself. Mm-hmm.
I must bring up that you co-wrote the book for the Tina musical. That every time I watch a clip of, I'm obviously living for. The performance, the actress who plays her is shocking. To me, writing a jukebox musical seems just impossible because you're stringing together songs that otherwise really have nothing to do with each other other than they belong on a greatest hits compilation with one another. So tell me about the struggle to put something like that together, and is it hell on earth and are you okay?
Man, it's crazy because Tina was my first musical. I love music, and I think there's a musicality to my writing approach. But to take on such a gargantuan project like that, I don't know what was going through my mind. Like, who I thought I was to be, you know, flying over to Switzerland and sitting across from Tina the Turner. But there was something that I felt I needed to explore in writing her story. Like, I know that a lot of people think they know her story. And oftentimes we point to the What's Love Got to Do With It movie and we focus on the abuse. But I wanted to focus on her triumph. I wanted to focus on what was life beyond Ike. And I think you get a taste of it in What's Love Got to Do With It, but how did she do that? And I wanted people mm-hmm. to understand how she climbed up out of that abyss. And so I was like, okay, I got to do this. And plus, she a Southern girl. She from Tennessee, just like me. So I was like, I'm in. So going to Switzerland and sitting across from the queen was just transformative. It's life-changing because, you know, you see this icon. And you realize very quickly that she's a human being mm-hmm. and she has struggled through what she went through. And yet she still, you know, persists. Like, this woman has had kidney replacements. Like, it's crazy how much she has survived. And so in terms of talking to her about the music and how we were going to retell a story that people thought they knew, you know, she never actually wrote any of her songs. She only wrote one of her songs. It was Nutbush City Limits. And so we were just like, how are we going to, you know, use this music that, you know, belongs on a compilation album, right? How are we going to use this music to tell her story in a way that pushes the narrative forward and reveals character? If it's not her character, it's Ike's character, it's her sister or her mother, whatever. So what was so interesting is, like, when I started listening to all of the music, I was like, Tina, you actually have been singing songs that were a reflection of your life at that time anyway. Like, everything, like, What's Love Got to Do With It? Like, she was tired of it. She was sick and tired of it all. And so she gravitated towards that song, even though she didn't like musically where it was. She was like, oh, this ain't really rock. I'm trying to be, you know, a rock singer, and this sound a little too synthy, a little too pop. And yet she still sang that song. So it was a tremendous task to just take this woman's catalog, figure out where in her story we were going to use which song. And so we decided to give ourselves this rule, and that we were going to be very anachronistic. We were going to use songs from the 80s in the 60s, mm-hmm. song from the 60s in the 80s, just because it, you didn't necessarily need it to roll out linearly, even though we ended up telling her story in the musical in a linear fashion. And I think what we learned, you know, from audience members, like they loved the fact that they could get a taste of all those hits, and they were out of order, and it was okay for them to go on that journey in that way.
It worked. You know, I mean, I saw it after Adrienne Warren came back after hurting her ankle. And she had the brace on, and she fucking slayed that show. It's so great, and it's one of the better jukebox musicals like I've ever seen, and I really thought it like really represented her. I mean, first of all, I have a Tina, the movie, the French What's Love Got to Do With It poster up on my wall with my favorite actress, Miss Angela Bassett, on it, which brings me to my last question before we let you go. You've worked with Queen Tina, and then you've also worked with Angela Bassett in your Broadway debut, The Mountaintop. It's her and Samuel L. Jackson, and that is a play about Martin Luther King's last day, and Angela Bassett plays an angel who comes to visit him, you know, before he dies. And my question is just like, what's it like, one, working with Miss Queen Bassett, and two, she was on the show last year, too, and like, what stories are you just drawn to telling then? You're like, you told Martin Luther King's story, like P-Valley, Tina Turner.
Yeah. I must say, I am drawn to ordinary, extraordinary people. You know, Tina is this girl from the cotton fields of Nutbush, Tennessee, and yet she became a rock and roll goddess. You know, Dr. King, this preacher in Atlanta, changed the entire world, quite frankly. You know, should be a saint, right? You know, a lot of people think of him as such. And then these strippers, these people who we don't respect, a lot of people don't respect, and yet what they can do with their bodies, it goes beyond how their bodies look, but it's about what their bodies can do. They can take you to the sky on a Saturday night. I feel as though for me, it's always about striving to show Black folks, Black women specifically, in unexpected ways, and to reveal how extraordinary the most ordinary person is. Mm-hmm. I feel as though it's about representing those who are voiceless, representing folks who have been made to feel invisible, because I've been made to feel invisible in my life. I think that's the main reason why I even got into storytelling. It's like, I wanted to see myself. I started out as an actor who was in libraries trying to pull plays off the shelf that had scenes for me, and yet I couldn't find them. And so I was like, I'm gonna write those plays then. And that's always been a part of my journey. Like, how can I revise the narrative? How can I add myself to the narrative? Because I truly do feel like existence is resistance.
Mm-hmm. And then Miss Bassett.
You know what? We still text. That's how.
Oh my God.
She is. Obviously, you walk in, she's like the most beautiful person in the world.
Yes.
That's the chocolate skin that she has been blessed with. God just made a reflection of herself in Angela Bassett. Just stunning, and also a stunning spirit. And what I love so much about her is that you expect that people who got all that celebrity and whatnot, they just gonna walk into the rehearsal room and they gonna start calling the shots. They gonna be bossy and whatnot. She was so humble. She was so hardworking. She never questioned everything. Everything was yes and, yes and. And that's the best artist to work with. Like, she is truly a stunning human being. From the Ruta to the Tuta, like as an artist, as a mother, as a director, you know, she just has everything. And I think that's why her art is so damn good, because of the depth that she has as a woman.
walking in this world. And I've just been so grateful that we've been actually been able to keep in touch. Because, you know, oftentimes when you're working on stuff, you form a little family for a little bit, and then y'all kind of just, you know, go about your separate ways. But not Miss Bassett. She's family.
Mm. Oh, that's so good. Great. Her, like, crackling, vivacious, consummate brilliance. Like, she's always been that way. I just rewatched the movie Passion Fish recently, which she appears in for, like, 6 seconds. And she gets, like, a moment, and she's even fabulous in that. So I think she might have a flawless career. And I just want to say before you go, shout out to my favorite Tina Turner song that gets no love, Typical Male. I just wanted everyone to go see listen to Typical Male.
You know we were trying to figure out how to put it up in the show. I was like, yeah. Let's go! Let's go! But no, she was like, that's all right, Katora, but she's like, I like that song, though, just so y'all know.
Thank you so much for being here, Katori. I mean, truly amazing person, amazing playwright, an amazing TV creator. Got a second season, already renewed.
Yes.
Cannot wait for more. Love everything about it. Thank you so much.
Aww.
For everything.
Thanks for letting me come on. I listen to you guys so Aww. Much. Yeah.
That's incredibly flattering of us.
I do. So I was so Thank excited you. To come on.
Taylor Swift seemed to be having as productive a quarantine as the rest of us until last Thursday when she announced the surprise release of a new album. And we didn't have to wait long. Folklore dropped to near universal praise.
Probably her best reviewed album.
Yeah.
This is news to me. Taylor dropped an album?
Yeah. She she changed the game with that digital drop. No, she didn't.
No, but she did not. I do not know where I was.
I'm sorry, Beehive.
It's okay.
I was just joking. Okay.
The only surprise drop I care about this week is Fenty skincare line, and that's all we heard about. That's all the girls and I heard about. So tell me about this Folklore album. What's it called?
You are so fucking rude.
Folklore?
Listen, Folklore, which she created with the help of Aaron Dessner of The National, who we love.
We love
The National. Jack Antonoff also, you know, hops on some tracks. Because when isn't he on one of the white girls' pop albums?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's all he does.
And
he goes from house to house, from Taylor's to Lana's to Lorde's to Carly's.
To the chicks. Like, all over the
place. Right. He is everywhere.
He's the white whisperer. Yeah.
I asked to work with him and he said no. He really only works with white women.
He is Aparna from Indian Matchmaking. He is looking to work with someone a little bit more fair, okay?
Fair skin to nice, please.
But here's my thing about this album. We talked about Lover last year on the show. And my thing about Taylor Swift has always been that her music, since its inception, when we started realizing that she wrote songs about her love interest, you know, and about her reactions to how she's depicted in the press, each album has sort of been a response to what people are thinking about her. Reputation was largely about the Kanye West, Kim Kardashian drama. There was a lot of snake imagery because people were calling her a snake online. Then there was Lover, a sort of back to basics album of her really trying to get into songwriting and emotion because she felt that with Reputation, she was ignored by the Grammys, like a place that has routinely celebrated her, and she really thought that she had to get it right. And weirdly, during quarantine, this album feels rushed, but it also feels necessary in a way that I would say a Taylor Swift album has never felt. And it's stripped down in terms of production, and I feel like that really highlights her songwriting. I think she's a very good songwriter, you know, and an album like this wouldn't be able to hold up without good songwriting to go with the stripped down nature of it. You know, it's not 1989, which is just bombastic, like pop and production and things to distract you from the lyrics of Shake It Off.
I will say, I feel like the thing Taylor Swift historically for me has done best is match the kind of high school drama of her lyrics with bombastic production. That's why I like 1989 the best. Like, mm-hmm. it plays up the torrid relationships with, you know, really theatrical production. And so instinctively, I would say that something really pared down where you're focusing on the imagery of her songwriting would be something I dislike. But I would say for an album that really eschews a big pop hook, like, there's nothing super Swedish feeling about this album at all. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It does carry me throughout it, even if I'm not obsessed with it. I still think her lyrics feature too much of what I would call, like, the imagery is way too pleasing to me. Like, every mm-hmm. image she brings up to me sounds like desktop wallpaper or dorm room poster. Or, you know, it's like, it's all about, like, streetlights and lipstick and, you know,
and
just
Levi's and white shirts. I know exactly what you're saying. I'm acting like I didn't like the album, which I didn't. But I do, because it's clearly a departure from her most recent work, because I was so tired of the, like, synth pop, all this stuff she was doing, that just indie pop, trying to make things literally work for her. And yeah, that was fun. I cannot deny the fact that Taylor Swift is one of the best songwriters that we have in pop right now. But the production on this was absolutely beautiful and haunting, transformative. Erin Dessner did an amazing job. And this is the only album she could release right now.
Yeah.
I needed something pensive, something thoughtful. This really reminds me of the very first Taylor Swift album that we got, her debut album that is mm-hmm. called Taylor Swift. And it just reminds me, again, of a young girl with her guitar and her ideas. And that's what I loved about Taylor Swift. Now, on the flip side, these lyrics are awful. I have not heard a single line that I enjoy. Like, they're all nonsensical, abstract, fucking catch-all fortune cookie lyrics. And it's just a snooze fest. Like, nothing is cohesive. Nothing feels good to me. It's just kind of nice. Kind of nice. And that's how I feel about the whole album.
Right. She goes for nice a lot. Something that alienates me from the quote-unquote, like, gritty reality of what she's singing about, because she's going for something gritty and earthy here, is mm-hmm. that, one, again, routinely I don't know what she's talking about. And two, she insists on this dreamlike quality, this fairy tale thing. Like, again, we're bringing up Peter Pan and Wendy. There's a Gatsby aspect to the song about the holiday house. And there's a kind of Baz Luhrmann level majesty about everything. And I kind of just prefer, in my songwriting, sardonic stuff. And I wish there was a little bit more of actual humor in it.
Here's my mm-hmm. thing. I think it's funny. I think that you can't deny lines like,
oh, here we go.
In my defense, I have none. I love that fucking line. You know, I love when she's singing, like, the greatest films of all time were never made. Her song, Exile.
What does that mean? What does the greatest films of all time were never made mean? I don't understand what that means.
I can abstract. That I can abstract something is that, like, there are beautiful stories that could have been told about a relationship, but they never got to the point where they told the story. That I thought was
beautiful. Here's my thing, especially because there's also between her fan base a lot of parsing of her sexuality with lyrics too, and
that
there's, you know, songs on here which you know, have sort of, like, you know, lesbian tint, particularly Betty, but this is an album where it's not from her perspective too, you know. It's an album where it's called Folklore because she's telling stories and doing things from other perspectives, and I think that helped her step outside of the box of responding to what people were thinking about her. And I would say that lyric, you're like, what does that mean? It reminds me of Visions of Gideon, a song by Sufjan Stevens, who I would also mm-hmm. compare to this album. You know, I feel like she was emulating a lot of Sufjan's work on this.
I'm not Invisible String is very Sufjan, you know, Sufjan Stevens.
I'm not the biggest Sufjan stan. I've been getting more into him lately through my best friend, but I will say that, like, when I did listen to him and the work that I have really dove into, and just the lore around Sufjan and the way that we discuss him has always been like, is he writing about Jesus? Is he writing about being gay? You know,
mm-hmm,
and there's always that distance there. And I would say, like, the Visions of Gideon, like, is it a video? You know, that is talking about memories that don't really exist, but memories that could still be playing along in your head. I think that there is a lot of longing on this album.
Totally.
I think that there is a lot of sadness for her. I find the lyrics very evocative. Invisible String, like, there's no way you can't tell me that song isn't beautiful. Tears Ricochet, that is gorgeous. August is so fucking evocative.
And don't say Cardigan. And don't say Cardigan. This girl sang.
Oh, I mean, I think Cardigan is fun, but it's a very goofy song. And she's also selling a cardigan on her website. Stupid. I'm like, this marketing tool is beautiful.
And then there's a track, Mad Woman, that I wanted to tell you guys my issues with. She has a track called Mad Woman, and then the lyrics are literally, and you'll poke the bear till her claws come out, and you'll find something to wrap your noose around. Speak to it. What do you mean? What do you mean? Why? I feel like that word is so invocative of something else, and I feel like I don't need to even say it, that any smart person who was aware wouldn't choose that word. Mm.
Historically, something I've called an issue with Taylor Swift is that I feel like what she's interested in is pretty small. Like, it's about, like, glorification of the drama of relationships a lot of the time. But then I think about the history of popular songwriting, and namely the people we call geniuses and that we've celebrated since the beginning of rock and roll, for example, is all men glorifying women and treating aloof women as goddesses that are just out of reach, etc. So in a way, Taylor Swift being the preeminent songwriter of our time is a course correction, I think, and I am happy about that. I wish there was actual gritty reality in the lyrics that she wants us to think are grittily real.
I would just also argue, as a person who loves melodrama, you know, like the films of Douglas Sirk, I would say that I see the longing and the sadness within the bright, poppy prettiness. And I think that it is, there's a thing, you know, about films like Written on the Wind and Magnificent Obsession, where you see, like, Jane Wyman, like, surrounded by beauty and surrounded by color and lushness, and then she goes blind, and I feel like that makes it all the more sadder, you know? And I think that there is sadness and there is longing in her writing about things that connect with a lot of young girls and women, you know? And I think that people, you know, were also trying to bring up comparisons to, you know, like Billie Eilish or like Phoebe Bridger and et cetera, whatever, you know? But I feel like this is very much the tradition of the music that I've been rewatching The O.C., I said. Like, the music that we were listening to that was on The O.C., like, music of The O.C.
Definitely.
Volume 4, you know?
Yeah.
That's when, like, people were really listening, like, Sufjan, Def Cab for Cutie, et cetera. And I think that this is a female reclamation of that. We were all recently on Twitter doing that, like, 4 albums from high school that people were listening to. And unless you were a faggot, a lot of your albums were mostly just like moody men, you know, like Ben Folds and Guster, shit like that. And I think that this is music for kids who grew up in that era and can see the sadness in something that is also pretty and pristine. And here I am fucking standing Taylor Swift.
Taylor, a Swiftie, a full Swiftie. My last thought on this album is it gave me the same feeling that Miss Americana gave me, the documentary about Taylor Swift, which was not that she was giving us some type of thinly veiled attempt at vulnerability. I think this is her being her most vulnerable. I don't think the veil is thin. I think there's not much behind the veil. That's all I have to say. Otherwise,
I like that remark. That's interesting.
I run her credit. I really do. But I mean, she's 30 and the lyrics feel like a 7th grade girl in my choir class wrote them. And that's all I have to say about that.
I think there is more behind the veil, but I also think that she isn't really willing to go there yet, unfortunately. I do really enjoy this album.
Yeah.
Is it my favorite Taylor Swift album? No. Do I think it's evocative of other things? Yes. Particularly national albums or a Sufjan album, particularly, you know, like Carrie and Lowell, the album that he wrote after his mom's death. That is an album that feels similar to this in sound and in scope, but that album is so heartbreaking and emotional. And I will say, Lewis, that I disagree that there aren't good lyrics on this, but I will also agree that I remember when we were reading that Fiona Apple interview and she was talking about how she thought that she could respect Louis C.K., but then it turned out that his comedy wasn't being honest and she couldn't respect him then. And like, if you're an artist, you need to be like so vulnerable that like you scare yourself. And if there's one criticism of folklore, I do not think it scared Taylor Swift to make this album.
I hear that. I will also say, by the way, my favorite thing about the album is that I think she kind of uses her voice in new ways. It stems to me from the song Lover from the last album, where
her lower register.
Yeah, she finds like a lullaby quality that is not, that has more in it than just soothing you. I feel like there's something in her voice now that is, you can hear reflectiveness and you can hear a really deep sadness. Like, to me, this album has depression in it, and that I think is well expressed and produced very well.
Yes.
It's funny that we brought up Billie Eilish, because I will say that there has been a shift in the way women are singing now, the way pop girls are singing now, because Billie doesn't wail. Billie doesn't ever go above 3 decibels and is able to have control and purity and raspiness in her voice. And it's a beautiful thing. And I do think this is Taylor's best song album, for sure. I think she sings the best on this.
Yeah. It's such an interesting choice how she sings, I think.
It's definitely her best. My favorite is still 1989, and then also Reputation. But this is inching up there. I still need more time to sit with it, but I think it's a triumph. And also, just like, if I sound like I'm like here standing Miss Taylor now, it is because
only in contrast to me. How it's not.
It is like, well, it is also just like, how fucking nice is it to be able to listen to a Taylor Swift album without like having to have the conversation about, is this about Kanye, or the conversation about like who she voted for, right? Like, she's come out and been like, vote, fuck Trump, etc. Kanye is off in Brigadoon, I guess, right now. And like, it is finally an album of hers that it's able to exist without all of that. And thank fucking God, because I can just listen to the music in peace.
Right, right.
From beginning to end, I can actually finish this album. I mean, I'm not going to finish it again. One listen was enough. But in theory, I could listen to it again.
August and Seven, probably my favorite tracks, yes.
And that's showbiz, baby.
Okay.
All right, when we're back, keep it. And we're back for our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Hello, 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 y'all.
Hello.
Who wants to go first?
I can. I have a lot to say, and it's going to be angry, so here we are. Okay. First of all, Keep It to the company that creates and produces this podcast, Crooked Media. Why? I received a suspicious package last week, and I was expecting wall art for my home. It looked to be that. It was big enough to be wall art, and it was not that. It was my concerned overlord friend Tommy Vidor sending me a suggested backdrop for when we do the video portion of the show that you can see on Snapchat. In addition to small signs of this thing that I'm about to show, he also gave me this. It is a giant Jon Favreau head.
Get that the fuck off the camera.
Guys,
dead ass.
Look at
this. Turn the cameras off.
Get it off.
This is in my home. Me, Lewis, I live with it. It's now here. If I want to throw it out, I need to like call somebody. It's so huge. And he is so menacing.
It's massive.
And just because he's a new father, and I'm supposed to like sympathize with him for that, but we're committed to a brand on this show, and that's not inviting Jon Favreau on it. So I don't know what's happened. Now I like am obligated to like say the name. Should we just talk about the other Jon Favreau to fuck with him?
This is offensive. I got something to say. Mm-hmm. First of all, congratulations to Emily Favreau. Congratulations to the birth of Charlie Favreau.
Sure.
A Leo. Oh, I am precious. Very, very happy for her. Jon Favreau, I am not happy for you. I am not
Charlie
happy for
run.
This. I am not happy for this scheme that I know that you cooked up to get a life-sized, bigger than life-sized version of your head on Zoom to taunt me on my birthday.
Right.
Of all days.
It's really sickening.
Jon Favreau, you are dead to me. And if I were to pass you in the street, dying of thirst, I would not give you a drink of water, and I would let the vultures have their way with you.
Beautifully said.
Yeah, I was propelled into this Jon Favreau hate that you guys maintained, and I didn't come to understand that it is barely a bit, huh?
No.
Look at this, Aida! They sent a huge totem of Jon Favreau to Lewis's home to terrorize me.
Do you know what Crooked Media is? It's the Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski is my boss. They send me suspicious packages that I open up, and now I'm stuck with it.
The Kaczynski method. Look at this.
It's like the monkey's fucking paw over here. Yeah. But my real keep it this week is to my favorite SiriusXM radio station, SiriusXM The Groove, which is old school R&B, plays everything from like Earth, Wind & Fire to Lisa.
Come on, SiriusXM.
They do this thing where they will occasionally shift a station to be just all one artist for a week. And I was very worried that SiriusXM The Groove had turned into an all Michael Jackson station. Absolutely not. We already have talked about the conundrum of having to listen to Remember the Time and then having to not sing to it because we've canceled Michael Jackson. But I would like to cancel that keep it because they just turned it into an all Prince station. And that is exactly what I'm talking about. I just want to give a shout out to radio in general. I love radio because it's the only time I flip the channels anymore. It's exciting to me. It makes me think of a childhood in a fun way while I'm driving to and from nowhere because we don't leave our homes.
Lewis, who the fuck are you? What do you dream of at night? Like, how do you have SiriusXM and you use it? How does it ail you so much? Like, this is like you read a phone book for leisure energy that you're giving me right now. Okay. But I'm happy, and I'm happy that your SiriusXM radio station didn't get changed.
Yeah. No, I was worried it was permanent. That did scare me for a while.
Okay. Well, this week, my keep it goes to a series of things. Of course, it's always internet reactions, but also it stems in some man doing something fucking stupid. And this week it is 50 Cent, who I hate talking about, but I feel like I need to talk about what happened to Meg Thee Stallion.
Fofty?
So Meg, as I'm sure you guys have seen, was shot in her 2 feet about 2 weeks ago. It was right after my birthday. It was on the 12th. And of course, that's devastating to find out that this young woman had to get surgery because she was shot in the foot by Canadian R&B singer, alleged R&B singer, Tory Lanez. And she's had to get surgery to remove bullets from both of her feet. And she took to Instagram Live a couple days ago to talk about her experience. And baby girl could not even finish a sentence because this is clearly the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to her. And well, I don't want to say that because she also does talk about having to lose her parents and placing her love and time into toxic relationships like Tory Lanez or whatever was going on with that. I mean, that's still to be found out. But immediately after Meg got hurt, the internet was full of jokes about her well-being. Like, literally within seconds, 50 Cent posted a meme about it. And, of course, it was a Friday reference, the movie Friday, because 45-year-old black men, like, only have one realm of reference and one grab bag of things to talk about, and it's one fucking John Singleton movie that is amazing, but it's just...
It's the Mean Girls of that demo.
Yeah.
They need a criterion for niggas. Like, I'm not expecting people to sit there and watch... The Handmaid, you know, like the 60s.
Yes.
Japanese.
Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
But can we get like a criterion with some black shit?
Diversify.
So you don't have to get the same reference constantly.
The same Ricky joke all the time. I'm tired of it. So he posted that meme and immediately deleted it and took to social media again to apologize. It is so frustrating to see him apologizing for something he clearly has no remorse in and is just pressured to do so. This happens all the time. Like, I feel like my keep it every time is stop being on fuck shit and stop lying and pretending like you care when you don't, especially when you're someone who has clearly not valued black women and their bodies for the whole of your career. And more sadly, you probably don't even value your own body. This is the same man who made a whole career of capitalizing off the fact that he was shot 9 times. So my heart is breaking. My heart is not just breaking for Meg. My heart is breaking for her having to read all these comments. And 5 minutes ago, we loved Meg and we wanted to see her dancing. And now the girl is in physical pain and nobody is there to help. Like,
it's also other women, you know, like,
yes.
Shout out to Drea.
Boo, bitch.
Who I believe got her Fenty partnership snatched. And photos of her removed from the Instagram because she made a joke about Meg getting shot. And I'm like, why are you making jokes about her being shot at all?
Yeah.
You know?
Immediately.
Chrissy Teigen got dragged too. Her joke actually wasn't even about Meg getting shot. People were doing this dumb meme on Twitter that has always happened. There's always some dumb meme on Twitter. But this was the one where it was like, I'd make a joke about writers, but like I have to turn it in late. Like something like that. Hers was like, I have a joke about Meg Thee Stallion, but I have to twerk on it.
Stupid.
No, yeah, you know, it's just like, stupid. Okay. But
I
like,
get it.
It's... You know, she's like, she loves Meg, and she wasn't thinking about the being shot incident. But, you know, she was dragged because it was like, now's not the time to be making jokes about Meg.
Yeah.
And people did bring up that, you know, like there's the time that we've talked about it on a show before too, you know, her Covenza Day Walls incident, you know. So, you know, I think that like people weren't ready to check for Chrissy and a joke about a black woman right now.
Also, by the way, I just want to say the way we heard about this Megan Thee Stallion incident was just through what we've heard from Megan Thee Stallion herself on Instagram. It's like a very strange...
The media's doing a shitty job. A very shitty job.
Right. It's like... Yeah. It's very unclear to me what is going on, and it seems just horrible, and she's just... It's like tip of the iceberg what we know, so it's very scary.
It's wild because it feels like, for any other incident, like this should be bigger news, and the media, TMZ, some shit should be digging into what really happened.
I know.
We're not really getting answers, and it frustrates me so much. And it also just frustrates me that nobody is running over Tory Lanez in the streets.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And but we've seen, you know, with incidents like Tekashi, Chris Brown, people with violence towards women who are men, they just sort of get away with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take to cancel Robert Kelly? So,
I feel for
Megan so much, and it must be so horrible to see something horrendous like this happen to you and see the media sort of not really care, and to also just see people in your own community making jokes about it.
Also, Meg hasn't even fully talked, and maybe she won't, but talk about the terror that happened, because I was on TMZ this morning and they had recently released a video, like footage of her getting out of the car with blood coming out of her feet and just her not being able to move, but the cops telling her to move and her hands are in the air, and it's very painful. I would not recommend watching it, but yeah, so things are coming out, but I do understand also, yeah, the media is not covering it. We're not getting full information. And why would we? Because Meg Thee Stallion is a black woman. So peace with her. Okay, sorry. What is your keep it, Ira?
My keep it this week is to Christopher Nolan.
Oh, right.
And Warner Brothers, who are continuing to pretend like this movie Tenet is going to come out this year, who are also insistent that it needs to come out this year. Do we need this movie right now? The release date has been pushed back so many times, and now it's been announced that Tenet will be released internationally in August ahead of a U.S. debut in select cities over Labor Day weekend. What is going to change between now and Labor Day weekend where my ass is going to feel comfortable being up in a movie theater? Period.
I appreciated Billy Eichner's tweet about it, which is, if they wanted to really fuck with us, they'd say they released Tenet in summer 2017.
And then the fact that it's now going to be released internationally. So what, either one, the movie's going to leak online, or hey, keep it, listeners, in Paris, if you want to go see Tenet, you know, just roll up to the movie theater and say, bonjour, un billet pour Tenet, s'il vous plaît. Bring your camcorder, do some recording, and then send it to me.
The pronunciation of camcorder was particularly horrible. I just want to know.
I'm giving him, no, Lewis, birthday pass. One birthday pass today.
But no, it's either going to leak or we'll at least be able to read the fucking Wikipedia description. I just do not get the insistence that this movie needs to come out this year. Right in August, September? Like, is it a stealth campaign for Biden?
Right. Yeah. What's the urgency?
Like, is it a get out the vote thing? Like, does it need to drop before Election Day? I don't
right. James
get it.
Bond's like James Bond's like, check me out in 2021. I don't care.
But. Mulan.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman. Like, what is the tea?
The vaccine is in the movie, and they've just been pushing it. So we'll know soon. We'll know very soon.
Christopher Nolan, chill the fuck out. Truly.
Accept yourself. Yeah.
Learn from this and grow. When a fucking coronavirus outbreak happens because some people crowded into a movie theater to see this flick, and you know they will. Because you just had white people up in the Hamptons going to see a fucking Chainsmokers concert with an opening set from the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who's a DJ, apparently. What is wrong with your people, Lewis?
I would love to know.
Because I know that, because I can guarantee there wasn't a single black person at that Chainsmokers concert. all right. That's our show this week.
Yep.
Au revoir to our listeners. who will be seeing Tenet very soon. Thank you to Katori Hall. And once again, congratulations to Emily Favreau and newborn baby, Charlie Favreau. Mm. None for John Favreau.
And also, once again, happy birthday to Ira, a.k.a. Leslie Caron.
Happy birthday, girl.
A bientôt. Keep It is a production of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Our digital team is Nadine Mokonian and Milo Kent. Thank you to Brian Sebel for production support every week.